from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, a lifelong Roman Catholic, historian Gary Wills has been an ardent critic of the Catholic Church's history and teachings throughout his career. In his new book, The Future of the Catholic Church with Pope Francis, he focuses on how the current pontiff, who has spoken on controversial issues like sexual abuse, homosexuality, abortion, and climate change, can serve as an agent of change for the church. And we'll start off asking him about controversies involving the local archdiocese. Join us for Forum. It's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and author Gary Wills joins us in studio for this morning's opening Forum program, opening Forum Hour. Professor Emeritus of History at Northwestern University and author of many books on history and culture, including ones on George Washington, the Kennedy family, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, and religion in America. He is a lifetime Catholic, and he's also distinguished himself as an author of many books and articles on the Catholic Church and Catholicism, including most recently The Future of the Catholic Church with Pope Francis. And we welcome Gary Wills back to the Forum program. Good to have you here.
Oh, it's great to be back.
Let me begin, actually, by sort of outlining a couple of stories which have been very much in the news, and they're local, and they may not be familiar to you or a lot of our listeners, but they certainly have been getting a lot of attention and a lot of press. The first one is one that was broken by Doug Sovereign over at KCBS, and it involves the Archdiocese's decision to install a system to repel the homeless at St. Mary's Cathedral, which is essentially the principal church of the Archdiocese. These were water sprinklers, and these water sprinklers actually were used for the past couple of years. They came to light because of Doug Sovereign's story. These essentially drenched homeless people who were in the alcoves and turned out violated city building and safety rules, or codes. So the church decided they would take them out. It apologized. It said it was ill-conceived because there was a lot of criticism, even though the church has done a great deal for the homeless and certainly brought their record to bear on that. It had the opposite effect of what they intended, is what they've said, for public consumption. And they also pointed out that people leave needles there and there are feces and there are all kinds of dangerous things. But there's a good deal of indignation about this spraying, especially in a drought, gallons of water. So I'm wondering, with this story having a good deal of currency now and also following on the heels of the Archbishop Salvatore Corleone's mandate, really, to require teachers to reject all kinds of subjects like homosexual relations as gravely evil behavior, not to teach them students about these kinds of things in any way that would be against the church's rulings, and also in their private lives. I mean, he was talking about the necessity for them to tend to their private conduct and their private behavior. What I want to get at here is you've done so much work about the church hierarchy and the way decisions come down, and it seems like decisions come down ex cathedra from not necessarily the pontiff, but from the bishops and the archbishop.
Yes. This story...
I should say ex cathedra, the seat of authority.
This story has an interesting parallel. In Rome, the Pope has been so outgoing toward the homeless that they have started clustering at the Via della Conciliazione that goes into the Piazza Santo Pietro, that is right on the Vatican's doorsteps. And in great numbers, they have collected there. And the Pope was made aware of that. He didn't spray them. He sent them bedrolls, sleeping bags. There's the contrast between being a Christian and being a self-righteous so-called Catholic.
Well, this ties in with a good deal of the sanguine view you have about Pope Francis. You feel that he can be a real reformer, despite the church doctrine and despite all of the, well, resistance he's particularly getting because of the way he's viewed as someone maybe not necessarily too compassionate or too kind or well-meaning, but somebody going against doctrine.
Well, I am very optimistic because he knows change does not originate with him. When he came in second at the preceding conclave when Benedict was chosen, and he was asked at the time, what name would you take if you had been elected? And he said, John the 23rd. Now, John the 23rd was presided over a great deal of change, but it didn't initiate with him, only in the fact that he called together the Second Vatican Council. The changes took place there, the body of bishops expressing the body of Christ, the people of God. Great changes took place there, and he could have played the role of autocrat and said, I like some of these changes, and I'll accept them, and I don't like some, and I'll reject them, and that's my decree. He didn't do that. He didn't like some things, but he certainly would not override a council. The council is the highest authority. You know, you've already used terms that everyone uses. You say the church installed the sprinklers and took them away, and the church has a great record of charity. Those two uses of church are very important. When people talk about the church, they often mean the Pope or the hierarchy. That's not what is the church. The church is the people of God. That was the normal usage for centuries, and the Second Vatican Council went back to that. And this Pope has said over and over again in his statements, the church is the people of God. So he hopes for change in the church, but he knows he can't dictate it. He held a synod last year, and those are recurring things since Vatican II, a meeting of all the bishops in Rome to discuss serious issues, replicating councils like Nicaea, which got together and discussed the basic doctrines of the church. John Paul II had said, you're to discuss in secret, and you're to give a report to me, and I'll use it any way I want. In this case, there was a leak that showed a more welcoming language to gays and to divorced Catholics, and there was an angry reaction in the synod that made for a watering down of the statement, and that seemed to be a rebuke to the Pope. He congratulated them on their differences and said, openness and honesty in what you're thinking is exactly what we need. But he also said, let's all join this conversation. And he published the whole proceeding, gave a speech rejoicing in the openness of discussion. And now the bishops see, before the last synod, he said, canvass your faithful. Find out what they need and want and think, and bring those results to the synod. Now, some of the bishops did that. Some did it reluctantly. Some did not do it at all. This time, I think they know they should take it seriously, and they know going into the synod that will take place this year that how they vote and what they say is going to be on the record. And the people of God are in total discord from much of the hierarchy. On all of those things that you mentioned that the cardinal wants teachers to adhere to, the best polling by Pew and Georgetown and the Chicago Diocese proves that a majority of Catholics, over 80% of Catholics use contraceptives in their fertile years. But 52% of Catholics think abortion is should be legally possible. In all these cases, the actual church is living a different life from what the hierarchy says. For instance,
there's also probably a lot of politics, though, isn't there?
Of course,
I mean, jockeying for higher positions to be a cardinal
it's careerism, and he has attacked careerism. The bishops know they're all using contraceptives out there, and the priests know, and I've never heard I go to church every Sunday. I've never heard a homily against contraception because they know that's a dead issue. It's a settled issue. Then why do they keep bringing it up when they become bishops? Because that's looking to Rome. And John Paul had said a litmus test. You can't stray at all on contraception or abortion or married priests or any of those things that a majority of Catholics are for.
Well, Benedict said it too, didn't he? I mean, he was Cardinal Ratzinger. He was the moral authority.
Of course, of course. And, you know, it's interesting what the Pope said on the airplane. He was asked about the contraceptive issue. And he said, well, we know what the doctrine is. But, he said, it's a woman's choice to be worked out with her confessor, which, of course, is exactly what's happening now. Confessors are not trying to enforce that, and they know it.
He also compared confession to a torture chamber.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, there are all of these kind of highlights and road signs for people that suggest that this pope is extraordinary in terms of his attitudes, his humanity, and the kind of changes that may accrue under him. In fact, you point out, I want to get into some people who are more critical with you and get your response to that, but you point out that he had an article in the Washington Post where you said he really can play a central role in terms of world peace and avoiding what may be a holy war between religions because he's had good relations with Islamic leaders past in Argentina and so forth. And in many ways, he represents a good deal of interfaith harmony and amity.
Absolutely. He says in his dealings with the Muslims, which are very close, that there's only one God. We're all talking about the same thing, whether it's Allah or Yahweh, or Christos, we're all addressing the God who made us, and he loves us all. And our way of showing that love is to respect the efforts of others, to find God, to reflect his love. So he's like the namesake he took, finally, St. Francis of Assisi, who went out to everybody. By the way, what's really interesting about choosing that name is that Francis was not a priest. He wasn't in the hierarchy in any way, and yet he was a great radiator of love throughout the church and beyond. You know, it's a symbol, but it's a nice symbol that he preached to birds and beasts.
And gave the city its name.
Yeah, right.
Talking to Gary Wills, by the way, Emeritus Professor of History at Northwestern. His new book is The Future of the Catholic Church with Pope Francis. Previous books, many of them include Why Priests, A Failed Tradition, which we discussed on Forum. And you can actually meet him tonight. He'll be at the Community Church of Sebastopol with Copperfield Books at 7 p.m. But he's here with us, and we'll give you an opportunity to chime in and join this conversation and bring any questions to the fore. I wanted to ask about some things that have been on the other side. Obviously, the right has been somewhat antipathetic to this pope, but there's also been criticism that have come even from other sources. For example, despite his saying, "Who am I to judge?" and a lot of people were concerned about statements he made about gender identity, mm-hmm. Especially comparing it, gender ideologues to ideological colonization and talking about this as like a nuclear threat almost. Mm-hmm. But even more than that, there's been concern about where he stands or how strongly he stands and what he's able to do vis-a-vis all of the sexual abuse. He certainly rhetorically made a great number of statements that show, again, that he's on the right page as far as most people who condemn sexual abuse of children are concerned. But there was this appointment in Chile, and this is someone who has apparently had culpability in the past for at least ignoring or not doing anything about sexual abuse that was in his archdiocese?
Yeah, well, that's being put through the courts, of course. But he's not going to issue a sweeping statement on his position for a lot of reasons. John the 23rd, as they say, did not initiate change. He encouraged it and let the church change. And the church has been changing on that all along. Andrew Greeley, the sociologist priest who recently passed away, did study after study that showed that Catholics were much more open to gays than Protestants or even unbelievers. That's the church that I know and live with. Now, this pope has an assignment that's different from any others. He has living right next to him an ex-pope whose attitude is different from his, and he keeps up very good relations with him. He cites him constantly.
Stephen said recently he may also, well, in effect, retire. He says he misses going out and having pizza, right?
Well, not only that. He, in effect, endorsed Benedict's decision. He says that was a great heroic act. And when he said, I might not stay in this office until I die, he was talking about resigning for the reason that Benedict did. Benedict said, my full energies are not there anymore to do this important job. And the reason he said that is that he saw John Paul II decline into a slobbering, mumbling mess, and he didn't want to end up like that. I think I might have told you one time when I was here before that George Mitchell, who brought peace settlement to Ireland, was rewarded for that with a medal or whatever given by privately by the Pope, John Paul, toward the end of his life. And he was, I talked to him for an hour on this, to Mitchell, and he said a very nice Monsignor took him in, and the Pope was very warm and gave him his award. They exchanged pleasantries. And on the way out, he said to the Monsignor, what language was he speaking? And he said, English. He was indecipherable by it. Now, Benedict was a very close friend of his, and I think it was a great act that he said, I don't want to end up like that. And so people are trying to make a lot out of the Pope saying that. I think he went out of his way to say that, to congratulate Benedict, that a Pope should be able to resign. You know, George Washington was a pretty athletic man, but when he finished his first term, he was ready to resign. Speech was written and everything, and people put great pressure on him to stay in office because he was the unifying figure, and they feared that with him gone, the early republic would have a hard time of it. Well, when he finished his second term, they urged him again, and he said, I don't have the capacity. I'm not the man I was. So that led to the second two terms only tradition. Now, to be a hereditary monarch doesn't give you that freedom, but of course we don't live in the age of hereditary monarchs, which is the time when the Pope became so powerful. We live in a very democratic age, and I think Benedict has to be congratulated, and so does Francis.
Well, do you think Francis, I want to get back to something we mentioned before, but before I do you think that the Curia actually expected his positions to be what they have been?
Well, that's a complicated matter. His record, he began as a provincial of the Jesuits and in Argentina, and that was the time of the Dirty War when steering a course between guaranteeing the safety of his priests and not openly endorsing or collaborating with the military dictatorship was extremely difficult. And he says himself, I was wrong. I didn't do it the right way. I tried to find the right way, but I made the decision myself. I should have shared that decision. I should have consulted more people. And he blames that on the fact that at a time when the priests were flooding out of the priesthood, and even in the Jesuits, and few were coming in, the pool of talent for important offices was very small. So when he finished his 14-year course of studies, he had not had pastoral experience at all. His relations were with fellow students and teachers all that time. So he says it was a big mistake for them to put me in that office without experience of the people. But nonetheless, he was known in Rome as being unwelcome to Jesuits because the other Jesuits didn't like some of the things he did. And there was a rift that continued right up until his election. John Paul II, who hated Jesuits, made him Archbishop and cardinal. They didn't know exactly what his position was. They had a lot of reasons to choose him. They wanted someone from the Third World. That's an important frontier for the church. They wanted someone old. Once you have a long-term pope, certain rigidities set in, and the cardinals, the same thing happened with the long term of Pius XII when they chose John XXIII. And they said, well, he's old. He'll probably just be a stopgap pope until we have time to choose another one. That was in play. Here they said, this is a 77-year-old man. He won't be around for long. They said it about him before he said it about himself.
What is his, do we know what his attitude is toward John Paul II? Because, as you say, he had a lot of ecclesiastical yes men around him who were, for example, opposed to contraception. And he was sort of shutting off ordination for women. And Francis is... again, been criticized for saying, that female theologians are the strawberries on the cake and that childless women are selfish. Some statements, that people have jumped on.
Yeah, that he reflects the prejudices that he grew up with as we find people non-racist slipping into racist analogies here in America. But his heart is clear in the women friends that he's had, many, many of them. Some of them fallen away Catholics that didn't break the relationship with him. So I trust his heart.
His pastoral role.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. One of the things he likes to repeat over and over again is that a shepherd should know the smell of the sheep. And he said, you don't get that in a rectory. You have to go out to the sheep and find out what they're thinking. He said, popular piety is a very important way of instructing us in what people need and love.
And it's also the core of Jesus' teaching, feed my sheep.
Yes, yes.
We're coming up on a break here, but I was also struck by the fact that, speaking of Jesus, that you have said he never intended forgiveness to be up to church authorities. And there again, we get into what's vested in the church authorities. Let's actually get our listeners to get involved in this discussion. And just like Levy's Bread used to say, you don't have to be Jewish, you don't have to be Catholic to join our conversation. We, in fact, welcome your involvement. And you can call us now and certainly register not only your thoughts but feelings and raise any questions or comments you have. How do you feel about Pope Francis? Enthusiastic still? I know many people have been. When we've discussed or broached this topic before, concerns or about the church, because we're talking with Gary Wills, who is certainly one of the leading and most preeminent experts on this subject. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, and you can call us now. Again, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Or post any questions or comments you might have onto our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. You can also, of course, tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Talking with Emeritus Professor of History at Northwestern, Gary Wills, his book, The Future of the Catholic Church with Pope Francis. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're joined this hour in studio by Gary Wills. His new book is The Future of the Catholic Church with Pope Francis, and talking about a new era of change for the Catholic Church as Gary Wills sees it, and we certainly welcome your involvement in the program. You are indeed encouraged to join us, and you can do that by phone, 866-733-6786, or by email, forum@kqed.org. I'm going to go right to calls and emails here forthwith. Before I do, though, we mentioned another local story, which is not only a local story. It's all over the country now. Various archbishops and Catholic authorities coming out with these morality clauses, and I had mentioned that Archbishop Salvatore Corleone here in the Bay Area has essentially talked about evil behavior in the lives of teachers and how they essentially have to go along with the church teachings both in their private and public lives. And under that category comes contraception, abortion, same-sex marriage, sex outside of marriage, pornography. I mean, it's a long list of things that come under that category. Gary Wills, your thoughts?
I think it's rather unbecoming for a man to be so obsessed with sex. That's the trouble with celibacy. Nobody pays more attention to sex than a celibate, because if you go on a crash diet, that's the time when you most think about food. If you end up a life of drinking and get on the wagon, you're constantly thinking about booze. Well, that's the trouble with these poor men. They have nothing better to do than try to stop pornography. This Pope has said, we've got displaced priorities. The early church had married priests. There were married bishops. There were some of the popes were early popes were descended from a father who had been a pope and a grandfather, or a grandfather who had been a pope. This whole business is so misguided. You know, at first the authorities tried to derive from Scripture some kind of argument against contraception or abortion, say. Neither of those things is in Scripture, but they tried to force them in. For instance, it said that contraception and abortion are condemned in the story of Onan. Onan spilled his seed upon the ground, so he did not inseminate a woman, and that was wrong because you're just supposed to act according to nature, breed. Well, Bible scholars came along and said that was not Onan's sin. His sin was that he was obliged to beget a son for his dead brother with his dead brother's wife, the widow. Well, that was not any argument that a pope could use. That was used, though, by the way.
So they got it wrong.
Yeah, they got it very wrong. And so they tried to say, well, it's natural law. And they cited Aristotle. Aristotle made what Hume called the is-ought problem. If it happens in nature, then we should imitate it. A lot of things wrong with that is that all kinds of things happen in nature, for instance.
Including masturbation.
Yes. Animals, when there's a weakling that is affecting their progress, kill the defective. Aristotle had said, if you have two defective people breeding, you should abort the embryo, because the likelihood is that they will be deformed too. So when they try to go to natural law, they make the great mistake of thinking that nature does all kinds of good things and we should imitate those and just neglect all the bad things nature does, because they're not being natural. It's crazy. The flimsiness of the argument is so great that when Paul VI called together a panel of very learned, very loyal Catholics, bishops, theologians, lay people, to say, well, what is the natural law for contraception, against contraception? And the panel said, there is none. There's no argument. That so shocked Ottaviani, the head of the Curia, that he rushed in a bunch of loyal bishops to issue what he called a minority report, as if that had been foreseen at the outset. And he told Paul VI, if you change the teaching of your predecessor, the church will fall apart, because our aura of infallibility. And in effect, he said, we've been sending people to hell for using condoms. How are we going to get them out if we say it's okay?
Talking again with Gary Wills, and his new book is The Future of the Catholic Church with Pope Francis. I'm looking at an email here from a listener who says, as a Protestant, I still think Catholics get a lot of things wrong, as they do about my beliefs, but I love this Pope. His reforms are turning the church more into what Christ would have done. And you can, of course, register your own feelings about Pope Francis. We do welcome your involvement in the program. Let's go to our calls, in fact, and we begin, Robert, with you. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, you know, Professor Wills, my comment would be that, with all due respect, I think that your thinking is reflective of that of a large subset of folks who sort of wishfully think that Pope Francis is going to push things in the direction that the culture wants to go. And I, you know, I think there is an objective truth, and I think Pope Francis would agree with that. And those who say, use terms like good to describe what the, you know, the current cultural understanding is, I think they're the ones that are confused, not the church's magisterium.
Well, you're using church as the magisterium, as if that were the church. It's not. And when you talk about the culture, the way the culture is going, Catholicism itself is going in a certain direction. 52% of Catholics think that abortion should be permitted under law. 80% and more think contraception should be permitted. Heavy majorities think that priests should marry and women should be ordained. Cardinal Ratzinger was asked, "Aren't you upset that so many Catholics don't obey your teaching?" And he said, "No, not at all. Dogma does not come from votes." So he doesn't know much history. That's exactly where dogma came from. Our principal dogmas, the Trinity, the Incarnation, etc., were set up by councils in the 4th and 5th century in Nicaea and Chalcedon. One man, one vote. Hundreds of bishops got together. The Bishop of Rome, by the way, was not there. And they voted on these things. There was a majority vote and a minority vote, and the majority prevailed by voting. That's why we believe in the Trinity, what we believe in the Trinity and what we believe about the Incarnation. And you talk about going with the culture. Well, the church has often done that, and sometimes in a bad way. The body of believers is no more infallible than the rulers. For instance,
I thought papal infallibility is in some way supreme to whomever.
No, it's a dead letter. It's only been used once in a very safe way. Pius IX called together a council and forced that doctrine on them because he was losing his land realm. He was ceasing to be a monarch, which he had been for centuries, the Pope had been. And so in a compensatory way, he got a very resistant council to say, the Pope is infallible under certain conditions. It has to be a central core matter, de fide, and has to be pronounced on his authority as infallible, ex cathedra, from his seat of judgment. John Henry Newman said at the time, there are some powers that are too great to be used, and that turned out to be true of this, because to meet all of those definitions, there's been only one infallible statement, and it was non-controversial. Pius XII said that Mary was assumed into heaven at her death. Nobody questioned that. You know, Jesus said the good thief beside him will go into heaven with him that day.
This is Barabbas.
It was a kind of test thing. But even then, there were a lot of people who didn't object to the doctrine, but to his using it for this purpose. And he never used it again, and no other pope has used it again. So infallibility is a technical term, and it's a dead letter like many parts of our tradition. You know, indulgences, interdicts, the ban on usury, all of those things are dead letters because the church just walked away from them. They knew that that was not a way to live the love of God in their time.
Which are things that, again, give you hope about change. And
absolutely.
Let me bring another caller on here, and we go, Beth, to you. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I have a question, I guess a question and a comment. The first part of it is Archbishop Cordiglione. I'm wondering if there's any way that he can be moved out of San Francisco, and he's so out of step. I'm from San Francisco, and he's so out of step with what the general Catholic population feels here. In my fantasy world, we have Bishop Daly, who is in San Jose now, being moved up to Seattle, and would love to have him come back and be the Archbishop. He grew up here, and he understands the population. Can that happen? I mean, how does it happen mechanically in the church?
Well, sometimes it happens, and it happened rapidly in some cases recently. John Paul and Benedict quickly removed people who said anything about married priests, for instance, on the other side. But that kind of dictatorial power is not what Francis wants. He's not going to kick him out. He is presiding over a church in crisis, as did John the 23rd, and he's trying very wisely to do it through synods, new committees, new studies, new overseers, like the overseers of the Vatican Bank. I know a man who knows some of the accountants who have been called in on that, and he says they're very top-notch people.
And didn't he call a special commission on sexual abuse, in fact?
He sent to the UN to testify before the Human Rights Commission a delegate who admitted that they have defrocked 700 to 800 priests, which they hadn't published. One of the things about secrecy is that if you give away too much, they'll realize what's the scope of the problem. So that was not public knowledge until this pope.
Let me ask you, I want to get some more callers on and thank Beth for her call, but let me ask you just since we're talking about this, what you would anticipate come September when he's going to address the General Assembly. He's also going to meet with President Obama at the White House and meet with Ban Ki-moon at the United Nations. I mean, especially since you see him as a real light unto the world.
Yeah.
What do you hope to accomplish?
Of course, I can't predict that. He's a very unpredictable man. He says himself, God is a God of surprises. I want to be surprised myself every morning. So what people say is that he'll very likely talk about ecology. He will join the rest of the world, with America being one of the few protesters, in recognizing the crisis of the global warming and climate change. You know, this is, for people who really want to respect nature would like to try and save it, save the world. Natural law love should be for nature, for the whole ecological system. He's going to issue an encyclical on that. And so probably that will come up when he addresses Congress.
And we'll have some more callers up. Ella, join us. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you very much. I'm calling regarding the sainting of Father Sarah, which has created great anger and hurt among many people, indigenous and not. To call him progressive because of his stances on women or the LGBTQ community, the environment, etc., at the same time that he's giving this ultimate honor to someone seen as responsible for setting up a mission system that abused and torturously exploited men, women, and children on this continent, just seems, you know, in such contrast. And it seems almost as though the church is holding on to this idea or restating this concept that whether people are tortured and exploited, men, women, and children, if that system brings Catholicism, well, that was okay. And it sort of echoes other alignings with sort of really fascist or abusive figures in Europe during this last century. And I wonder what your response would be to that seeming contrast and the seeming willingness of the church to always abandon the indigenous people in the Americas.
Gary Wilson.
Well, actions speak louder than words. As the Archbishop, he certainly rescued people from torture in Argentina, and he was tactful in doing it. As I say, it will not help for him to denounce any of his predecessors. After all, one of them's living next door, and he's tried to keep up very good relations. He wants the smell of the sheep, but he also wants to listen to men who have preceded him and made mistakes, perhaps, but are people who tried to hold together the church. So he's on very good relations with Benedict, and he cites John Paul II constantly in his major statement, Joy of the Gospels. He sees himself as a reconciler rather than a dictator, and he wants to reconcile by the pastoral measures that he's adopted, telling the bishops, consult your people. You know, that is a direct conflict with what Cordiglione is doing. He's not consulting them. He's bossing them. He's bullying them. this pope is not a bully.
Let me thank Ella for her call, and let me get Lorena on next. Lorena, welcome.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I live here in San Francisco, and I've been a community organizer for the past 15 years in the Bay Area. Right now, I'm actually working for the Catholic Church. I work as a community organizer on issues on immigration and housing. And I'll tell you, in the last 15 years, I've never, ever seen the capacity to be able to talk to people at the churches with the priests, opening up our churches as places of hope for immigrants, stopping deportations, stopping evictions, as I've seen in the last 2 years. And I mean, partly Pope Francis, who I think whatever people want to say, they can say. But the truth is that we at the bottom, the people that are here, the working class people, people that the sheep, are really feeling this ability to be artisans of our own destiny, as he talks about. That's the solidarity we're creating. And I think Archbishop Cordiglione, people can disagree or agree, but in lots of ways, he's also letting us do a lot of work at the bottom. And I think that we can transform. We are in a big moment to transform what our faith is and to put it into action. So I just want people to consider, you know, there's a lot of theology and history, but then there's what's happening right now and how we can take a hold of it. So as a Catholic, as a Latina woman, as an immigrant woman, as a formerly undocumented person, I'm seeing my church stand with me, and that's important.
Lorena, I'm so glad you called. Thank you. Good to hear from you. Well, let's hear from another caller, and that's Chuck. Chuck, join us.
Good morning. As a lifelong practicing Catholic, I share most of Professor Will's ideas, but I'm afraid I'm more pessimistic than he, because we had two successive, rather conservative popes, and as well-meaning as they may have been, they saw to it that most of the hierarchy that were appointed, both as cardinals and bishops, were of like mind and very conservative. And assuming Pope Francis is not of a mind to just turn them out, how many years are we going to have to go through? Because he can say all the wonderful things from Rome, from the Vatican, and yet we have two local bishops, Barber and Cordiglione, who reflect that conservative mind. And I'm not sure the troops are always going to follow the general. So
it's also the bishop in Santa Rosa. He mentioned Oakland, where he's calling from, and San Francisco. Gary Wills.
Well, first I'd like to address the preceding question, because it's a very important one. One of the first things this pope did was go to Lampedusa, the island where refugees come stop off on their way into Italy. And a lot of Italians resent them, just as a lot of Americans resent our immigrants. He went there to grieve with them over the people who'd sunk on the sailing there, and pray with them and identify himself with them. Again, this is the kind of action he's taking. And, you know, one of the nice things about careerism is that bishops really love to thunder doctrine when that was their way to become cardinals. The careerism made them look up to Rome. In a way, careerism is now going to make bishops much more favorable to the poor. He's told them, don't live in palaces, don't drive flashy cars, and they're already shedding some of those things. The way up is a way down now for people who want to get on the good side of this pope. And the change should come from the bottom and will come from the bottom. We don't obey the pope like soldiers to a general. We've proved that by just ignoring the fact that there's a silly argument against contraception. And, you know, a lot of bishops had a tremendous problem with that. The whole idea that you should deny condoms to people with AIDS, that's inhumane to an extreme extent. And I know bishops who didn't like that position, but it was the only way that they could hold their authority and increase their authority was to go along with that deeply inhuman policy of, in effect, consigning people with AIDS to death, or people getting in danger of getting AIDS. So the church has to act, not just the authorities. And, for instance, confession has raised lots of problems lately in connection with the sexual abuse cases. Almost all of those people, those abused victims, went to confession to their abuser, and the abuser used confession to keep them silent. Said, "Oh, you're not supposed to tell what goes on here." That's true of the priests; it's not true of the people. So, the church will have to register its informed unconsent.
Looking at some emails here that I wanted to get on the record, this is Tricia who writes, "Archbishop Corleone is not attacking just attacking sexuality. He's trying to obliterate employee protections by calling on the ministerial exception in constitutional law and threatening termination for teachers and staff who speak in contradiction of Corleone's morality clause in school and out." Another listener writes, "I haven't heard much about the bishop or archbishop from Uganda that Pope Francis appointed. He will be one of the people choosing the next pope when the time comes. He has supported the lifetime imprisonment of gays in Uganda. I've liked Pope Francis, but was very disappointed with this appointment. It has affected my feelings about him."
Well, he's going to disappoint a lot of people. He disappoints me.
How does he disappoint you?
Because he doesn't have the ability to make all the kinds of changes that we need. I have good friends who are involved with SNAP, the abused victims. They're very unhappy with him. They don't realize that if he could do their will, he would be acting like a monarch. He has to protect the continuity of his own office and the church's own people. You know, the people of God does include bishops. They're not outside the church, but they're not the whole of the church or the boss of the church. So I think he's certainly not going to join the right wing because they're too mean. And he's not going to join the left wing like me because we're too snooty. We hurried to get rid of things after the Second Vatican Council in a foolish way, getting rid of fasting, of novena, of devotions, of Marian devotions, or mocking them as folk religion. This pope says popular piety can teach us. If you love the people, you love what they love. And we were not sufficiently aware of that. We had more the air of the seminar and the theological conference than the smell of the sheep.
I ask you a couple of questions that have come in from listeners that do regard perhaps Gary Wills as a member of the shepherd's flock. Tony writes, "Mr. Wills does not believe in transubstantiation, therefore he is not Catholic. For you to promote him as one is disingenuous." And Terry writes, "Mr. Wills, will you please describe how you reconcile your weekly mass attendance with what the institutional church is doing?"
Well, I go to communion as I would have gone in Augustine's time. Augustine said, "The body of Christ is you. It's not the bread and wine on the altar." When he put them there, he said, "That's you." And when he gave out communion, he said, "Receive what you are, the body of Christ." So the agape meal goes right back to Jesus' time, but transubstantiation doesn't. That came in the 13th century. And again, it's one of those attempts to use a natural philosophy to justify a mystery. Thomas Aquinas took from Aristotle the fact that there's a difference between substance and accident. The substance of a dog doesn't change whether he's white or black or big or small or any of those accidents. Well, Aquinas said, now we can explain why this bread is the body of Christ. It has the substance of Christ, but with the accidents of bread and wine. But Aristotle never said you could separate the two and send them off in different... A dog is a dog, whether it's white or black, but a white can't exist without the dog. And the so the idea that the bread and wine turn into Jesus. Well, even the gospel narrative makes that nonsensical. Jesus at the Last Supper hands bread to someone and says, "This is my body, eat my body." Well, they saw his body, the hand that was giving them this. It's clearly a symbol. He was not saying, "Bite my hand off, gnaw my arm." He wasn't. It's not cannibalism.
Talking again with Gary Wills. His new book is The Future of the Catholic Church with Pope Francis. And once again, he'll be at the Community Church of Sebastopol with Copperfield's books this evening at 7 p.m. Always good to have you here.
Oh, this is home.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate that and appreciate you. And we are here with all of you Monday through Friday from 9 to 11. We certainly appreciate your listenership, as I said, and you can continue this discussion online by going to kqed.org/forum. In the next hour, we're going to talk with the founder of Neuroscience, and Forum is produced by Judy, founder of Cognitive Neuroscience. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our interns are Megan Sussman and Nunu Teo. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.